Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
13 years ago, Jerry Yang was a PhD student at Stanford University. He and a friend had an idea for a company using this new thing called the Internet. The company was pretty successful. You might have heard of it, Yahoo. Today, CEO Terry Semel's out, and Jerry Yang's running the show. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Health Desk is supported by the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation working toward a high-performance health system. On the web at commonwealthfund.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 18th of June today, Monday, and it's good to have you with us. On the organizational chart, Yahoo co-founders Jerry Yang and David Filo are called the Chief Yahoos. Today, Yang's got another title. The board ousted six-year chief executive Terry Semel this afternoon and gave Yang the job. The move came after a tough shareholder meeting last week, one that focused in no small part on Yahoo's stumbling performance and Semel's big paycheck. The Associated Press calculates Semel made $71 million last year. We tracked down Fortune magazine's Adam Leshinsky on the roads of Silicon Valley someplace. Hey, Adam, how are you?
Good, Kai. How are you?
Good. I'm reading the press release here, and it says the board appreciates Terry Semel's service, but obviously they didn't appreciate it very much. They let him go today. Why?
Terry Semel was a great leader of Yahoo when he came on board in 2001, really rescued the company from its last point of oblivion. But for the last 2 years, he just hasn't been able to make the company do what it needed to do, which is to be an effective competitor to Google in terms of search advertising and in terms of letting Yahoo recognize make money off of all of its tremendous online traffic.
Is Jerry Yang, though, the person to do this? If Terry Semel, a movie studio executive, can't do it, then what's Jerry Yang going to do? Yes, he founded the company, but come on.
He co-founded the company, and he probably knows more about it than anyone else. But Jerry Yang, twice in the company's history, has handed off the reins to somebody else to be the CEO. So it's surprising that he would decide now that he wants to be the CEO of the company. I think you should look to them naming Susan Decker as the president as being a sign that the CEO job is now hers to lose. Or, in fact, perhaps they're looking for a replacement for Jerry Yang. I'm surprised that they didn't name him interim CEO, but this gives him that much more authority for the time that he is in the job.
What are he and Susan Decker going to have to do to get this company where investors want it to be?
They may not have to do that much if their search advertising program, which they've been initiating for the past few months, works. Then they'll be able to at least make up some ground against Google. However, Yahoo also needs to invest in the rest of its properties. They've been siphoning so much money away from everything that doesn't have to do with search that they're not growing particularly well everywhere else. And that's going to need to be a focus of the company.
Adam Leshinsky is a senior writer at Fortune magazine. Adam, drive carefully, will you?
Thanks, Kai. I will.
Never fear. We asked him to pull over before we really started talking. Some things to remember now before you invest in Yahoo or anything else. Past performance is not an indicator of future returns. It's buy low, sell high, not the other way around. And don't for a second believe that the Supreme Court's your friend. The justices ruled today on dot-com IPOs. The legal concept at issue before the justices was a reasonably well-known one, antitrust. The case was whether investment banks and stockbrokers had a secret handshake going on during the dot-com days when initial stock offerings were a dime a dozen. The justices ruled there should only be one policeman on the IPO beat and that it should be the Securities and Exchange Commission, not judges, who administer federal antitrust laws. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Back in the 90s tech boom, Wall Street banks and brokers would get together to plan the IPOs of hot new startup companies. Frequently, the scenario would involve banks buying additional shares of the new stock after the initial release to keep the momentum going. But a group of investors sued the Wall Street firms, including Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and Merrill Lynch, charging that their cooperation artificially drove up the price of new stocks and violated antitrust laws. Today, the Supreme Court threw out the antitrust case, saying only the SEC has the power to regulate IPO underwriters. But Salil Mehra, who used to work in the Justice Department's antitrust division, says investors don't have as many protections under SEC regulations.
The antitrust laws do bring certain benefits, like treble damages and the possibility of attorney's fees, that other areas of law may not get you.
Mehra says today's ruling could make IPO investments riskier and more expensive. But former SEC Commissioner Joseph Grundfest says investors who feel cheated by what they regard as Wall Street collusion have the option of taking their case to the SEC.
The important thing is not how some plaintiff's lawyers wish the law might be in a way that could benefit them pretty substantially. The question for the Supreme Court is, what is the law as written today?
Grundfest says those who think antitrust rules should apply will have to get Congress to change the law. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Federal law prohibits members of Congress from hiring family members to work in their offices on Capitol Hill. But the letter of the law is a good deal fuzzier when it comes to how lawmakers can spend their campaign cash. A report out today details how scores of members in both parties have used campaign funds to enrich their relatives. Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
72 members of the House of Representatives have paid their own relatives more than $5 million to work on their congressional campaigns in the past 6 years. That's according to a report released today by CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Melanie Sloan is CREW's executive director.
Members of Congress are public servants, and they're not supposed to be using their position to be a profit center for their entire family.
Sloan says the problem's bipartisan. It involves 30 Democrats and 43 Republicans. Some spouses cleared more than $250,000 in 6 years. 7 members of the House paid their kids to work in their campaigns. Chris Cannon, a Republican from Utah, has employed 6 of his 8 children in his campaigns. He's paid them almost $70,000 in total.
He kind of jokingly says, you know, they're cheap labor.
Fred Piccolo is Cannon's communications director.
You know, his children worked very hard on his campaigns. They've been involved in every one of them. And he believes they shouldn't go unpaid just because he's their father.
While some find these payments unseemly, they are perfectly legal, at least for now. Congressman Adam Schiff introduced a bill earlier this month that would end payments to spouses and require immediate disclosure whenever a member of Congress hires a family member for his or her campaign.
I think the practice of employing spouses to do campaign work in particular has been so abused that it just has to be stopped.
CREW plans to dig into Senate campaigns next. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
You've probably heard of the 7 wonders of the world. Chances are you've never seen one of them, though. The only ones still standing are the pyramids at Giza in Egypt. There's a worldwide competition going on right now to pick 7 new wonders of the world, and for many countries, particularly those in Latin America, it's not just national pride that's at stake. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Organizers call it the first global vote in history, 60 million votes and counting. People can pick from a list of 20 contenders by email, text, or telephone.
Please now enter the 2-number code.
The competition closes in 2 weeks on 7-7 of 07. Tia Veering, spokeswoman for the New 7 Wonders Foundation, says the frontrunners are
the Taj Mahal, the Great Wall of China, the Easter Island statues, the Colosseum in Rome, and Petra in Jordan, the rose red city in the desert. A new one in the top 10, this current ranking, was the Statue of Christ Redeemer in Rio de Janeiro.
That sudden jump wasn't by accident. Brazil's president urged people to vote for Christ the Redeemer in his weekly radio address. The presidents of Peru and Chile are plugging sites in their countries. In Mexico, cans of Coca-Cola promote the Mayan site of Chichen Itza. Jonathan Tortolo is director of sustainable tourism for the National Geographic Society. He says these Latin American countries covet the 7 wonders recognition and the tourist dollars it would bring.
For a developing country, this can make a big difference.
But he says increased exposure is a two-edged sword, as big crowds can overwhelm a site. The U.S. also has a candidate in the mix, the Statue of Liberty. But so far, she hasn't even broken into the top 10. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Bond yields fell today, and based on the past couple of weeks, we all know what that means, right? Yeah, except it didn't happen today. Investors couldn't quite figure things out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice got on the phone today with the new Palestinian Prime Minister Salem Fayyad, and she had some very welcome news for him. Following the events of the past week or so in the Gaza Strip, the White House has decided to restore direct aid to the Palestinian Authority. The European Union did the same thing a couple of hours earlier, though whether money will change anything among the Palestinians or between Israel and the Palestinians is still up in the air. Dennis Ross is a longtime Middle East peace negotiator. Mr. Ross, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
You at all surprised that the funding's been restored?
I'm not surprised. I thought it was probably likely. There's a tendency, obviously, to want to ensure that Abu Mazen will succeed. And I think that's a good instinct. But I think if we just do business the way we have in the past with Abu Mazen, we're not going to see Fatah change. And Fatah needs to change. Fatah needs to reform itself. This is a very good time to provide support, but also to make sure that there are a number of conditions. We can provide some to begin with, but if a lot more is going to be provided, we really need to see that there's not only going to be transparency, but we're going to see the money going to purposes that will benefit all Palestinians, at least will benefit and allow Fatah to show that it's not the same old Fatah.
Abu Mazen, of course, another name for the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Do you think he's going to use some of this money for Palestinians in Gaza?
I think he will want to because he has, first of all, he's the president in his eyes of all Palestinians in the Palestinian Authority, so he will want to. The trick is going to be, how do you do it? Because it's not going to be so easy to get money there that Hamas won't itself be able to get its hands on, or Hamas may well, in fact, respond in some way to try to prevent monies from going to Fatah groups within Gaza and not going to them.
So is this, do you think, the economic route, perhaps, of two Palestinian states if they can't work together on this money?
Well, it's going to be hard to produce that because, in the end, what you're going to have in Gaza is a failed state. This is an area that has about 70% functional unemployment. It needs to be able to trade with Israel, and if Hamas is, in fact, controlling the crossing points, the Israelis are very unlikely to believe that there's going to be security at the crossing points, or they can count on bombs not being smuggled in. So if, in fact, Hamas wants to be adopting a position where it's able to do better within Gaza, it's going to need to adjust its behaviors.
On the larger political point, is Western money going to be able to help solve in any way the Palestinians' divisions?
You know, I'm not sure that it can solve the division, but it can begin to make it clear that certain kinds of behaviors really do benefit. We do have an interest in having Fatah in the West Bank, especially if it will reform itself, demonstrate that it's a model of success. We have a real interest in having moderates look like they're successful at a time when Islamists are not. What we've seen in the Middle East more generally is it's the Islamists who always seem to be on a roll and the moderates who always seem to be on the defensive. So helping to promote a moderate model of success could be something that's important not only for Palestinians but also for the region more generally.
The Palestinian Authority has never been a model of accounting rectitude. How concerned would you be if you were Secretary of State Rice about this money getting to where it's supposed to get to?
Well, I would be concerned, and I think the good news is that you have Salem Fayyad, who is a highly credible figure, who is both the Prime Minister and the finance minister. He actually, knowing him as I do, he is someone who would like some pretty tight restrictions on how everything can operate because it actually strengthens his hands. He wants transparency for his own reasons. Palestinians need transparency as a way of proving that business is going to be done differently. So I would use the fact that we're now ready to provide the money to work out a very clear system of how it's going to go, and I would also use it as a lever to push for reform among Fatah and within Fatah, and I'd have Salem Fayyad focus not only on paying salaries and building an institutionalized structure, but also on making sure that outside monies are going to go to the grassroots in a way that demonstrates that life is really changing and that Fatah is really changing.
Dennis Ross was the envoy to the Middle East for the first President Bush and for President Clinton. His new book is called Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. Mr. Ross, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, balancing love and marriage when you're working in different towns.
And frankly, you know, in terms of having children, I mean, this has been a really difficult conversation for us over the years. It's like, because I cannot imagine having to commute while raising kids.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street today as merger excitement was offset by rising oil prices. The Dow Industrials fell 26 points, almost 0.2% to 13,612. The NASDAQ was almost flat, slipping 0.1% to end the day at 2,626. The S&P 500 fell 0.1%, almost 2 points to 1,531. The price of a barrel of oil rose above $69 today, that after Nigerian oil unions called a strike for this weekend. Alcoa shares rose 3% on reports that BHP Billiton may make an offer for the aluminum producer, but burger chain Wendy's went the other way. It fell almost 4% to $38.26 after it cut its earnings forecast. The company said it's thinking about putting itself up for sale. Yahoo picked up almost 3%, and that was before the news of the CEO change, up 6% in after-hours trading. Google, just in case you're curious, gained 1.7% today, $515 a share. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for May. President Bush meets with the Prime Minister of Israel at the White House. And the Senate Foreign Relations Committee holds a hearing on the passport backlog. Officials expect to turn around about 18 million passports this year, 6 million more than in 2006. But delays in processing are ruining some folks' travel plans. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Two American presidents have gone there since the war ended, Clinton and the incumbent Bush. Now the president of Vietnam's on his way here. Nguyen Minh Trit left Hanoi this morning for a six-day visit, one that will focus largely on trade and how Vietnam can get more American companies doing business there. Chris Runkle is the chairman of the U.S.-Vietnam Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Runkle, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
The president's going to Los Angeles and then New York before he finally winds up in Washington next Friday. Who's his audience on this trip?
Well, I think his audience is U.S. business. Vietnam is trying to move up the food chain. They've already had a lot of investment in textiles and shoes, all those sort of businesses that really are seeking out the lower labor cost environments. And now, just last year, they got a big investment from Intel, which is investing $1 billion just outside of Ho Chi Minh City. And what they're trying to do is to get more investments like that.
What's your experience doing business over there? As you take companies over there and try to introduce them around and get them to meet the right people, is the environment receptive or is it still a little bit guarded?
No, it's very, very receptive and very, very competitive. Vietnam offers better incentives than China in terms of taxes. They're offering tax rates that can go to as low as 10%, a waiver of import duties for bringing in equipment. All of these are very competitive if you compare them to other countries in the region.
What about the downside risk? It can't be all great news going on in there. I mean, there must be some risk of corruption and the government perhaps frowning on certain operations.
No location is perfect, and Vietnam still has its problems. One issue that's immediately comes to attention is the weakness of infrastructure, ports, road systems, even the electric grid in certain areas is not what it should be. Also, corruption still is a major problem in Vietnam. It's a big concern for investors, and it's a big concern for the government.
So if you had a client who wanted to make a molded plastic something or a pair of tennis shoes or whatever it is, and they were considering China and Vietnam, how would you balance out that equation for them?
I think it gets down to whether they see the China market as a big portion of their target. If their focus is really only on export back to the U.S. market or into the EU, Vietnam can be very, very attractive. If their focus is more on the regional market and includes China, then China can oftentimes be a much better location.
The government in Beijing has made an implicit agreement with its people that economic reforms will be allowed to flourish at the cost of political freedoms. Is that happening with Hanoi and the people of Vietnam?
I think so. Most Vietnamese have made an implicit bargain with the government, they are willing to stay out of politics as long as the Vietnamese government continues to spread prosperity and to increase the opportunities for them to have a better life.
Chris Runkle is a business consultant in Asia and Vietnam. He's also the chair of the U.S.-Vietnam Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Runkle, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Love and marriage are on the syllabus today at Cornell University. The school is hosting its fifth annual Dual Careers Conference. A lot of married couples find themselves having to figure out who gives up what so the other can take the job of a lifetime. Marketplace's Jane Lindholm reports from the Work and Family Desk. It's a problem especially common in academia.
Bob Prash and Falguni Sheth met and fell in love when they were both studying at Berkeley in the 80s. They've been together for 19 years, but that was pretty much the only time they worked and lived in the same place.
The first time you have a phone fight, it's like, and especially being an economist, it just strikes me as ultimate futility. I mean, not only are you like in a bad mood because you had an argument, but you're paying money for it, long distance money. And it's like, this is really stupid.
But as a philosopher, I kind of feel like, what's the principle? You got to hash it out. It doesn't matter where you are.
As you may have noticed, even their arguments are cerebral. Prash is an economics professor at Middlebury College in Vermont. Sheth teaches philosophy and political science at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. Their academic passion is what brought them together, but it's also what keeps them apart.
We have a number of friends who were academics who cheerfully, one half, but wistfully, would say, okay, you know, we want to be together, and so one of us will actually stop being an academic. And I think for us, that would really breed a resentment. You know, how can you ask somebody to give up what they do when that's such an integral part of who they are?
Prash and Sheth aren't alone in their predicament. Almost a third of all faculty and staff in higher education are partnered with other academics. They face huge hurdles when it comes to getting jobs in the same place. Andrea Davies Henderson is the research director at the Clayman Institute for Gender Studies at Stanford University. She says there are unique challenges for dual career couples in academia.
Unlike other employment sectors, medicine, law, elementary or high school teaching, you can work almost anywhere, provided you pass the state certifications. But in academia, doctoral training is so specialized that it makes employment options very few, and faculty positions are less concentrated in major metropolitan areas.
Which means couples often have to take jobs far apart from one another.
Things like two households, two cars, there's been a lot of expenditures that we wouldn't otherwise had to have. And, you know, academics, I mean, we're not doing badly now, but we haven't always done that well. And, you know, so it's made it hard to save money.
And frankly, you know, in terms of having children, I mean, this has been a really difficult conversation for us over the years. It's like, because I cannot imagine having to commute while raising kids.
But it's not just the couples that suffer. Universities are starting to find their best job candidates going elsewhere when their spouses can't find an offer to match. Evelyn Hammonds is the Senior Vice Provost for Faculty Development and Diversity at Harvard University.
If I'm a woman scientist and my spouse gets a great job at Harvard and I've got a great job at Georgetown, and Harvard doesn't try to help me find a great job in Cambridge, but Georgetown tries to help us both stay there, then, hey, we're going to stay in Washington.
That's getting schools around the country to partner up with their neighbors when it comes to hiring. Universities in several regions throughout the country have developed HERCs, Higher Education Recruitment Consortiums. There are HERCs in Northern California, Southern California, New Jersey, New England, New York, and others are starting up. They're basically clearinghouses for all available jobs at all participating schools in a region. HERC members hope that by collaborating, they'll be able to hire their top-tier candidates by luring them to the region, rather than placing the burden on only one institution. But this means that at the New England HERC, for example, Harvard and MIT are sharing information about positions. That kind of open exchange doesn't usually happen between schools who are more used to competing for professors. Nancy Ebersold helped create the very first HERC in Northern California in 2000. She says that was an initial concern.
But it was pretty quickly put to rest. Overall, there was a sense that there's enough talent out there, and we actually thought that by collaborating, we would create a competitive advantage for our area and for all the members of the HERC.
Andrea Henderson at the Clayman Institute for Gender Studies says this collaboration is a step in the right direction.
HERC is fantastic because it's changing the ways that universities do business.
She says before HERCs emerged, universities had their own ad hoc policies, but there was no standardized procedure for spousal hiring. And sometimes faculty and staff didn't even know what the policy on their own campus was. Bob Prash and Falguni Sheth say they could benefit from this type of accommodation. But Sheth is pessimistic. She says policies like this may make it easier to hire spouses, but with such specialized positions, it's still hard to find something perfect for both of them. Until then, she and her husband will continue living their separate lives.
It's really nice to be together, you know? And I just keep thinking, God, I don't want to do this forever. It's such a hard existence.
I'm Jane Lindholm for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, home builders are apparently still feeling crummy about the housing market's woes. An index that tracks builder perceptions about the market fell for the fourth month in a row, down to its lowest point in 16 years. That's according to the National Association of Home Builders today. It's more bad news for developers like D.R. Horton and Toll Brothers. Their earnings have been hit hard by the slide in demand for new homes. Stay tuned tomorrow. That's when the Commerce Department will report on housing starts and permits for more housing starts. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow spiraled down 26 points, almost 0.2%. The Nasdaq slipped 0.1%. We'll call that basically flat. The S&P 500 fell almost 2 points, about 0.1% there as well. Our producers include Megan Larson and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, Bolivia's indigenous economic revolution.
Look at all the pile of proposals. I have 22 project proposals that are worth altogether $12 billion investment.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.